Thank you guys, this is a new episode, and episode 11. We're interviewing Daniel Jones of the Aspie World. Yeah, we'll just get into the interview.
Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Hello. I'm fine, thanks, how are you?
Yeah, not too bad.
Okay, ready to start?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So for people who don't know you, would you like to introduce yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Daniel Jones, but my online pseudonym, if you will, is The Aspie World. And part of what I do is I'm an autism advocate, and I create content on autism on every single social media platform, including blogs and podcasts, to help educate people about autism in a fun and interesting way, because I have a diagnosis of Asperger's syndrome, ADHD, OCD, and dyslexia.
Cool. So first question. So on your awesome diagnosis video, you said you were about 9 when you went to do it. But it says here, you said when you were about 9, you didn't want to get on a bus with other kids, to swimming pool. So you were left in the school, to play computers. You remember saying that?
Yeah. So you kind of confused yourself a bit. I got my official diagnosis when I was 26, but when I was about 9 years old, obviously the school knew there was issues, obviously through my entire school career. But that's exactly right. Rather than go to the swimming pool with the school gym class, I just stay in the classroom. Yeah.
How did your parents react?
They didn't really care, to be honest with you. It was like early 90s, late 80s, so everything was a bit more lapsed. There was no real structure for kind of what's considered good practice. People could get away with all kinds of stuff, so I don't think there was any health and safety regulations broken, because there were none. So my parents didn't really care about the fact that I wasn't doing, as in they didn't see a safety issue with it. My parents were pleased with the fact that they were accommodating my need to not being able to go there, you know what I mean?
So you also said in that same video you were allowed to stay in at break to play on computers.
Yeah.
Did that help you in later life, or give you a disadvantage at social skills or an advantage in computing?
I think obviously it definitely gave me a disadvantage in social skills, because I learned all my social skills later on in life when I went to high school, because I met friends there. In terms of what it did for me while I was in primary school, the ability to go on the computers, one of the things I did was I looked at Encarta, which was an old encyclopedia, kind of like Wikipedia, but it was an old disk that you put in your computer. And so I used to study that. And so it kind of did help with my ability for research, and then obviously my computer skills as well. So there was an advantage to that.
So we went onto your Facebook page to ask people questions, and they sent in a lot. Some of them are similar to what I had planned originally. So okay, we're going to go through them now. This one's from Harmony, and it said, what made you want to go and pursue the diagnosis? And she says, the thing you said in one video, but they don't remember which one, so.
Okay. Well, the diagnosis came about because obviously having issues all the way through childhood, my parents, I was in and out of psychiatrists and psychologist offices and et cetera. Mm-hmm. So I did get a diagnosis when I was in high school of dyslexia. And then the psychologist was like, oh, he has short-term memory loss, he has attachment issues, anxiety, agoraphobia, basically a bunch of stuff that leaned into autism but didn't register as it. And the reason it didn't is because of the timing of it, so I was going to see doctors and stuff when I was in the mid-90s, and where I live in Wales, there was nobody that could diagnose autism back then, so that's why it was missed. The pursuit of the actual diagnosis was for two reasons, and one because of the other reason. Very quickly, my girlfriend's mother is a mental health nurse and thought I was on the spectrum and asked if I had a diagnosis. I said no. And then she said, oh, that's interesting, because blah, blah, blah. And then the reason we went to pursue the diagnosis was because the struggles and issues that I have in my life, then they said, well, you could potentially have access to help, maybe the key workers and stuff like that and therapy. But if you have the diagnosis, you need that to cross the criteria. So that's when we pursued the diagnosis.
Cool. So the next one's from Bradley. It says, so I'm just going to read what they've sent me. So it says, can you ask him how he schedules his days and how he balances his interests with his career goals?
That's interesting. My interests are my career goals. So I'm obsessed with growth strategy SEO and social media growth. I love it. Yeah. I love organic growth and like hacking, basically. I'm a growth hacker. So to me, it's kind of like my work and pleasure are the same thing. How do I schedule it? I basically have a bunch of different apps. I'm always refining my schedule. And basically, I use a bunch of different apps, but I mainly use my iPad Pro with my iPhone and Apple Watch as like a, they all like link together. So I kind of ask Siri to do stuff on my phone to remind me to do things. And then that appears in my calendar on my iPad. And that's how I remember to do things. Yeah. Mainly using scheduling apps. There's an app I use specifically though for routines, and that's called Timo. So Timo. And Timo's a really, really good app. And I'm pretty sure that you can get a discount if you use my link. And it's in the bottom of most of my videos. So definitely check out Timo, but they're really good. And there's a link to them actually on my website. But that's the app that I use mainly because it has like, you can set up an entire schedule and it'll up for routines and it will remind you and it goes through to your watch. And then it will tell you like how long you've got left on that task. It's very good.
Cool. So they also sent in another one that says, how do you deal with self-doubt in the abilities to achieve those goals?
I think as humans, we're already pre-programmed to create self-doubt because self-doubt creates the potential of failure, and the potential of failure drives the opposition, which is obviously success. So I think what we need to do and what I do is I look at self-doubt as a motivating factor for motivation. So I look at it and say, okay, okay, and I'll give you a small example. I'm dyslexic, like super dyslexic. And so when I get letters from the government, because they're so difficult to read, they actually send me an audio CD so I can listen to them because it's difficult to read the letters. Now, if you then take into consideration that I am a best-selling author with a book out in three languages, and I got a bestseller in the United States and the UK, you think, well, how on earth did a dyslexic guy do this, right? And it's a publishing deal as well. It's not like I did it myself. It's all as a proper official publisher. So the problem would be this. The self-doubt would be, oh, you know, I can't read for buggery and I'm going to have to, you know, I rely on aids and stuff for my entire life to read, which is typically true. But then I say, what's stopping me becoming an author? And I use that self-doubt of me saying, oh, I can't do it, to go, okay, well, why can't I do it? And then I look up the why, which is I can't write formal English because of my dyslexia. Then I find somebody who can write formal English who could, and I can dictate to them and then they could write. And that's exactly what happened. I found a ghostwriter who's already an author, and I spoke to her over eight sessions, for an hour long sessions, eight times. And then she was able to compile the book and we did it together and edited it together, and then out it goes. So it's really interesting how the self-doubt, the stuff that you look at yourself and think, I can't do those things, makes you think, well, if I can do those things, imagine how amazing that would feel. And just figure it out. It's a kind of like a problem solution issue.
Cool. Yeah, well, that makes sense. The next one's from Sammy, which says, how does he handle the pressure of being so popular and famous? Does it ever get too much?
It does. It really, really does. You know, I've had people come to my house. When you're walking outside, especially when a video goes viral on Facebook, for about like 2 or 3 months, when a video goes viral on Facebook, like you're bombarded with people. Like, we couldn't. And here's a funny story. Like, I was going, when I go shopping and stuff, like the cashiers and the tills are like, oh, hey, you're the guy from, you know, the video guy. I'm like, yeah, yeah, haha. But the pinnacle time when it came the worst was when it was my birthday in 2018, and I was really sick. I had kidney stones, but I didn't know. And so I was on my birthday day, I went out for dinner, and the people in the bar were like, oh, you're that guy from Facebook and YouTube. I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then I was in agony pain. I was trying to like just sit down and have a birthday meal, and they wanted to, but in pain, like, anyway. So I phoned the hospital and said, can I go, you know, can I come in and get seen? They said, yeah, okay. So I get to the hospital, and then the hospital rushed me off to the actual ward. So, cause they say, oh, you know, you've got kidney stones, I'm gonna have to do scans and all sorts. So I go to the ward, and the nurse who's getting my bed together was like, hey, I'm a really big fan of your videos. I love them. I'm like, thanks. I'm in real agony. I really need to sit down. Like, and then yeah. I get a wheelchair. Some guy comes up, gets me in a wheelchair, and puts me down to the scanning machine. And then when I get to the scanner, the scanning operative guy is like, oh, you're the dude with the videos. My wife loves your stuff, and she's never going to believe that, you know, we're doing this. Can I get a selfie? And I'm like, dude, I'm like literally dying. Like, put me in this machine, scan me, and let me have some painkillers. And so it did get to a point where, you know, when I'm in that situation where I'm already overwhelmed with things, like, it's a bit like, oh my goodness, can people just leave me alone? But at the end of the day, it's what you expect. I have to take the good with the bad. Like, I don't mind it. I actually really like when people say, hey, can I get a selfie? Or hey, you know, Dan, I watch your videos. I love that because it's those people who are my community. But at the same time, it does cause for some stress when you think, oh, I just want to relax, you know, and it's hard to find time to relax when you're around people who constantly want to. I think that the most is the amount of messages I get from people who are demanding of my time. So I get like messages and emails from people and they're like, you have to message me back. And like, almost it was, if it was my duty, like I'm just like, they snap their fingers and that's it. I have to message them. So that's probably the worst part of it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. The next one's from Debbie, and it says, how do you feel about being a parent, and can it be overwhelming?
Oh, man. Look, there's two questions there. Can it be overwhelming? Being a parent is excessively overwhelming because you have all these responsibilities, and it's, you kind of have to make it up as you go along. There's no guidebook. Nobody tells you what to do. It's hard to think about what you're doing because, you know, you're trying your best to either calm down a baby if they're scared or worried or crying or whatever, and then you're trying to figure out yourself, like, well, how do I even do this? I'm supposed to be doing something, but how do I do it? So it is overwhelming. The noise is very triggering. The constant mess and disorganization is very difficult to deal with. But at the same time, what's it like being a parent? Well, it's amazing being a parent. Like, I really enjoy, like, being my son's dad because I get a chance to help somebody. You know, he looks up to me, and like I'm able to show him, like, you know, be a role model, and I love that, and I love teaching him all these things, and, you know, make him a good person, and it's just crazy good because you get this little thing that loves you no matter what, and that's just such a cool feeling. So it kind of, like, it's both, you know, it's good and it's overwhelming. So I enjoy being a dad, but I also have times where I'm like, oh my goodness, I, you know, I do need some help, and that's why my partner is so good with it. You know, she's really good with the baby.
Cool. So they also did a second part. Is it a role you adapted to straight away, or are you still trying to figure it out?
Still trying to figure it out. You know, you adapt in certain areas, of course, because you kind of have to, you know, you hit the ground running when you have a baby. It's not a scary thing. It's just an interesting thing because a lot of people say, like, oh, your life changes. It turns your world upside down. It doesn't really do any of those things. It just adds a component to your life that is just something a little bit different, so you just accommodate for somebody else living with you. You know, it's like having a lodger or anything else, or having a dog, or, you know, it's just like having anything else. And so I'm still learning. Every single day you learn, because life is an ever-changing series of events, and so you have to roll with the punches and just really get on with the changes. And it's difficult to do because I'm not a huge fan of change. Lol.
Yeah.
But in terms of the change is trying to make sure that your child is secure and looked after the best way. So the change is kind of, you don't mind that kind of change, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. I've got a lot of these community questions. There's three left, but I thought I might as well get them all done. The next one, I'm going to butcher this name, but it's from CV. I'll try so that they can know it's their question, but it, for me, it reads like CV. Sorry if I butchered that, by the way. What do you love about being autistic?
What I love about it? My ability to retain information of large volumes and quantities. I think when people meet me or hang out with me for a very large time and we talk about a subject, you know, certain subjects, I know a lot about science. Obviously, I was able to do a degree in chemistry, which I think was down to the fact that I'm on the spectrum, and I think that's cool. But having to just effortlessly retain vast amounts of information and then regurgitate those as and when needed is cool. I didn't even realize I did this until people start pointing it out, you know, and you meet more people and have more friends and they point it out. And I think that's really fun. I like the thinking differently part.
Cool. So this one's from Leopoldo. Sorry if I butcher that, but it says, what advice / encouragement would you give for those starting a YouTube channel?
Sorry, can you say that again? Sorry.
What advice would you give to people starting a YouTube channel?
Advice? I would say that you just have to get out there and do it. Like, you just have to, like, just give it your all. You know, now is the best time to start a YouTube channel. It's never too late, but now is the best time. If you're going to, you know, everyone always tells, like, when's the best time to start a YouTube channel? Right now. This second, if you're thinking about it and you want to go and do it, I'd advise do it. It's the best thing I ever did. You have to know your trade. You can't just go into YouTube thinking, I'm going to film videos on my iPhone, chuck them onto the internet, have no effort in that, and then all of a sudden I'm going to be famous. That will never happen. And also, you can't go into it thinking, I'm going to do this and make loads of money. That doesn't happen either. You have to have a clear vision of, can you add value to people's lives? And then study the tools. It's kind of like if you did your first day on your job as a construction worker, they wouldn't just let you into the construction site and you go, you know, there you go. They'd give you an induction process. You'd have to learn safety regs. You have to learn how the job works before you could even do that job. So just like YouTube is a job. You have to learn how the systems work, how to get videos discovered, how keywords work, how thumbnails work, all that stuff. So do your research, plan it well, offer value, and keep a modest head. That's the best advice I can give.
Cool. So last one, and it's from, well, not last question, last one off there. This one's from Sophia, and it said, could you ask him how he went on with dating? And they've said that they tend to mask a lot, and then they never get asked on a second date.
How do I get on with dating? I've never been on a date. I've never been on a date. I've only ever had like two girlfriends. And so, you know, those two relationships, one, I was in college at the time studying, and the person that I was dating was in college studying as well. So we just had mutual, like, you know, we were in the same classes and stuff, and we crossed paths. Yeah. And so that's how I know that person. So I never really dated. And then my partner I'm with now, we never dated either. Like I was in a media, I came in to do a talk on media in college, again in the same college, and my partner I'm with now, she was there, and so she just, I was talking to her about what I do, and then that's how I know her. And yeah, and so it's kind of like I never really dated. But if I did date, I was having a conversation the other day because I just did a video review of Love on the Spectrum from Netflix, the new show, right? And one of the things I found really interesting is that, like, because I've never been on a date, I have no idea what I would do on a date or how I would, like, date people. I mean, it's just such a confusing world. My best advice would be, though, is to practice. I'm studying right now of the best techniques that I can offer to people. So I'm going to make some videos and courses and stuff on this for dating and stuff. And so I guess right now what I've come to realize is that practice makes progress. So the more that you can practice dating and rehearse, like, and study it, like, again, it's all down to studying the tools, then that's going to be the best way to do it. So the reason that you probably don't get asked back on a second date, from what I gather, is that dates take a long time. Like, you know, you could go on like 5 or 6 dates before you have one where you get a second date, which is absolutely fine, because you have to see if people are compatible and you have to kind of get to know people. You know, say you're very politically minded, and then you're left wing, and then you go on a date with somebody and they're right wing, then, you know, you're obviously not compatible like that. And so that's going to be a no second date, even if they, you know, you may be attracted to them. So there's a whole variable of things that would have to come into that. So that's the best advice I can give at the moment.
Okay, cool. So thanks to everyone who sent in questions. I'll go back to my one now. Sure. You were saying that you didn't really talk to people, correct? You said that in the video.
Yeah, I didn't really. I was like super shy. And like, I kind of didn't really, I didn't really talk to people other than my family, because like it was just difficult. It was a difficult task, you know. It's difficult to understand what people want from you, and it was just something that, it was not like I couldn't speak. It's just that, like, it was almost like selective mutism, really.
Okay, do you have an idea why some people on the spectrum don't speak? Like, some people don't speak at all, while other people seem to speak to lots of different people. Do you have an idea why that is?
So nonverbal autism is a more severe type of the way the condition of impacts somebody, and so they have a higher support need. So because autism is a communication issue in the brain, it affects everybody differently. So some people could have a great vocabulary and verbal speech, like myself. I feel like I have a really vast vocabulary and good verbal speech. I'm not excellent with socializing, but in terms of people who are nonverbal, they just, their brain hasn't developed the ability to connect the communication part of verbal expression of what they're trying to communicate. It doesn't mean that they can't communicate, it just means that they can't verbally communicate.
Okay, so now this question's just a bit for fun, because I actually watched half the diagnosis video, but I had lots of questions, so I was like, if I watch any more, it's going to go. But you said in one of them that you were interested in UFOs. You're still interested in that?
Of course, I know. It's one of my special interest subjects. I know a lot about it.
Do you have any conspiracies you believe?
Yeah, loads, man. My so everyone on the spectrum has a certain fascination with things, and I have a couple, but one of my main ones, and probably the main one, is the 9/11 terror attacks in America. As morbid as it sounds, I'm fascinated by it because I saw it as a puzzle because it didn't make sense, and so there's a huge conspiracy around that. I wouldn't say it's theoretical; I'd say it's just a conspiracy in general. So that's one of the biggest ones. But there's a huge conspiracy against the disclosure of extraterrestrial civilizations, definitely.
Yeah, so I did have a question that I was going to ask everyone. It says, what's your favorite band?
My favorite band is Blink-182.
Cool. You're in the band, right? Or you
I
were?
am.
Yeah,
No, I
cool.
am. I'm still in the band, yeah.
Oh, you're still doing it. Cool. So I didn't have much time to look into that because by the time I had a question, I had another interview to do. But what kind of got some sort of popularity first? Your YouTube channel or the band?
The band got popularity first. I've been playing music since I was about 15. So when I got to high school to deal with anxiety, I started playing musical instruments. So I self-taught myself to play like bass guitar, electric guitar, acoustic guitar, drums, violin, piano, banjo, ukulele, like just loads of different instruments, really. And then and from that, I made connections with people who were musicians in school. And then obviously I joined. I made a band with these people, and I'm still with them now. And so the band kind of like we I was into I've been in a band I was in a band before this, and then this band turned and the band I was in before this kind of turned into the band I'm in now. We just changed some members around, changed the name, it's different style of music. And so popularity with the band I'm in now kind of just rose because, if you're good at something, I guess people like it, and then you can just, get a bit of popularity. So we've had videos on like Kerrang television and stuff like that, and we've done some tours and just be on radio and on the BBC and things like that. And yeah, just do that the whole band scene thing. It's really cool. So that came first. And then my YouTube channel came afterwards, because the YouTube channel kind of came around by accident. It wasn't something that I did purposely. It just came by accident, but now obviously I do it purposely.
Okay, so are you signed by a label?
Yeah, we're signed to two labels. So it's signed to a label called TME, Tifa Music Entertainment in Japan. So we've got a record out in Japan right now, and it got to like number five when it was first released in Japan. That was kind of cool.
That's
And then
good.
so, yeah, that was really cool. We beat like Green Day and Blink-182 to the number five spot, which is crazy. And then we, yeah. And then we've signed to a label in America called Paper and Plastic Records, which is owned by the drummer from a band called Less Than Jake. So they're a big American ska punk band. They've been around for years. And but yeah, so their drummer signed us up. And so yeah, so we're signed to two different labels.
What's your style of music?
The style of music is typically like pop rock, pop punk, kind of like American high school punk rock, I guess. It's not like punk rock, like grimy, grungy stuff. It's like upbeat, poppy, kind of like Busted and McFly type of stuff, but a bit more American influence.
Yeah, cool. Sorry if it seemed like a lot of questions. Like I like music, like I love it. So
Sure.
I just find it cool. I had a question and I completely lost it, so I'll just move on to my next one.
Oh well,
I've
sorry.
had.
The band. Sorry, the band name is Straight Jacket Legends, by the way. So
Yeah,
if
yeah.
anyone wants to check it out,
Do
yeah.
you want me to? Is it okay if I play one of their songs at the end of this podcast? Because I'm allowed to use Spotify to get songs on.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, of course.
Cool, thank you. So I've interviewed a few people. I've interviewed Anne Hegarty off The Chase, and I've interviewed Luke Bearden and. Well, Tim, who's my grandma's friend, and they've all got autism. I'd recommend listening to them, by the way. But they have different. It seems like there's a different opinion on should people go and get a diagnosis. Like, for example, I think it was Anne that said, if you don't want it, you shouldn't get it. I'm not 100% sure. What do you think? Should people get a diagnosis, or is it just up to them?
Well, I mean, it simply comes down to a few things. Like a diagnosis of an autism spectrum condition or any condition for that matter, it targets the problem specifically. So then you can, I say problem in like, in very lightly, it targets the issue specifically so that you could then find the specific remedy for therapies. So, you know, if you don't get something diagnosed and you want help with something, then you won't know what help to give someone because you don't have the criteria. You don't know what it is. Because somebody may be saying that they think they're on the spectrum, but actually it could be something else. It could be schizophrenia or a personality disorder. It could be anything, really. So without proper diagnostic testing, then how are you even going to know? So that's one way to kind of think why a diagnosis is a good thing. Another thing is that some people do want access to help, and access to help is only available through official diagnostic papers. So, you know, if you're on the spectrum and you know it and you just need the diagnosis so that you can then access the help, because some people may need help with home and executive function and stuff like that. And so, you know, there's a bunch of reasons why. But then at the end of the day, some people may feel like they're on the spectrum, may not have a diagnosis, and that's absolutely fine as well. And they're not really wanting to get a diagnosis, and that's cool, because, you know, we're all individual at the end of the day. We don't have to all follow the same thing. So I think it's just down to your personal preference, really.
Cool. So we're nearly done, but in that you said help, how do you think help should be done? Because in my school, it's more they do the work than help. That's why I'm glad that I was diagnosed after I proved myself. And I think it's, I said it in Luke Bearden's, but I said it roughly in the middle, and it was quite a long interview. I said that it's, I don't think the help should be done how it is in most schools around the, well, in my area. It's not help, more as they tell you the answer, and then that person, instead of learning, doesn't bother, if you know what
yeah.
I mean.
Look, the education establishment isn't set up to accommodate anybody, let alone people on the autism spectrum. Yeah. SENCOs have a really difficult job, the Special Educational Needs Coordinator, for anyone who doesn't know what SENCO is. And now their job is to accommodate the learning needs of someone with a disability, but also stick within a curriculum guideline. I mean, how do you even do that when the curriculum was set up about 200 years ago to create factory workers? So the curriculum we're currently learning is outdated by a couple of hundred years. So if you try and adapt that to a condition that's only been studied for the past 30, you're completely at a loss. So that's the problem the SENCOs have, and it's a problem that the education systems have. Now, there are special needs schools, bridge schools all over the UK, that are more in touch with the right learning style and learning needs, which is great. But then it opens the conversation to another conundrum. You know, and I did a video on this specifically, like, are special education needs schools the way to go, or do we have to have mainstream schools and then the special educational needs schools are just like a buffer to get them into mainstream schools? You know, because what happens if you just go to a special educational needs school, then you may not have the experience of being around neurotypical kids, and there's maybe something that will benefit for doing that. Like, I went to a neurotypical kind of mainstream school and I learned loads of stuff from just being with friends, you know, and just picking things up because they taught me, because they realized that I didn't understand certain things, so they were able to teach me things. But then if I was in a special educational needs school, potentially I may not be able to have had those lessons from friends, you know. So it is it's a difficult one. It's a difficult conundrum. I think that reform to how SENCOs help in schools, and I think help starts with listening. So they need to listen to the students and find out what the issues are, and then target those specifically. And the PLSPs, or the personal learning plans, need to be tailored to the specific student at the beginning of the year before they even enter the classroom.
Yeah, and I agree. There's also a thing right now where schools get an autism accreditation. Me, personally, I don't agree with that being a thing. It's a nice idea, but because my idea, what I do this podcast for, is to raise understanding of autism, not awareness, because I think everyone's got awareness pretty now. Aware. If we're raising awareness, it seems a bit outdated to me. Yeah. But to raise understanding. And I think the autism accreditation, if you put a big badge up, it brings too much unnecessary attention to, oh, they need this. And it makes people like me who aren't severely affected. It's hard to get the right words, but.
Yeah, it's difficult. It is difficult. But the accreditation for a school or a public body or an education establishment to have for autism would be advantageous for a simple factor that if you're a parent and you have this autistic child and you've moved to an area and, you know, you go, oh, what's the best school to send them to? Oh, the school actually has an autism accreditation. You're going to feel more comfortable sending your kid there because you're going to think like they understand it more, which they will do. Obviously, they wouldn't have the accreditation otherwise. And so I think they're a good thing for aiming parents to go there. What you're talking about is bias from spectrum bias. So people saying, like, I get it all the time. Or you don't look autistic, or you don't sound autistic. It's like, well, what does an autistic person look and sound like, you know? And so it's not really the schools or the accreditation that causes that. It's the lack of or the increase of public ignorance that creates this. So the understanding is barriered. So I think things like you're doing with this, and the more, you know, more we can get people to do things like this and create more understanding, is going to change that and bridge that gap.
Yeah, I hope it does. It's got quite a bit of attention from the school, so I'm hoping to listen to it. And one of the things that I heard from a few people was, it's not like severe. And I'm like, what? Yeah, it's only like small.
Mild, or something they say, don't they? I've heard that.
Yeah, I don't like that personally. What do you think?
It's not. No, I don't like that, because, like, what even does that mean, you know? Like, I get like there are support needs. Some people, like, you know, who can't verbally talk will have higher support needs than me, and I get that. But it doesn't make me any less more vulnerable than them to certain areas. So I think it's just knowing that it's a spectrum and remembering that it's a section, it's a spectrum, and that's not just one way, and that has to be the way for everybody, because I think that's where people get lost, and then they go, oh, you must have it mildly then, because they've only ever seen someone who has got more severe needs.
Yeah, so we're pretty much done now. Last question is, how do you think autism is portrayed in the media?
I mean, almost non-existent at the moment, but I think it's getting there. It's getting better. We've got, like, The Good Doctor, Atypical, Power Rangers movie, you know, and you have all of these kind of autistic characters coming out, like The Accountant and stuff like that, which is interesting. Sheldon Cooper and Big Bang Theory, obviously, and then you've got Abed from Community. And I think what it's doing is it's slowly drip-feeding the reality of autism into Hollywood, and it has to be drip fed, because you have people right at the top who you know, for years they want this glitzy and glamorous look to anything that you watch, so you can digest it, because the majority of people just want to see nice looking men and women with nice smiles, you know, good figures, and that's all they want, you know. And typically you know, just smiley, bubbly people. They don't want somebody who could potentially have a serious condition that they want to talk about. And so I think the public understanding is changing now, because we're having that, we're having those discussions, and more people are being made aware of autism. So I think in the media it's slow but progressional, and I think it's really good. I think there is progress, and there's a lot to be done there, but it's getting better. And I'm noticing more autistic actors getting roles in things now, which is excellent.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. Is there anything you'd like to say?
No, if anyone's listening and they want to listen more to anything I have to say, or want to catch me on my socials, you can get me on theaspieworld.com, which is theaspieworld.com, which is my website, The Aspie World. And you can, you can hit me up on there. You can ask me questions on any of my social platforms, and I always reply. So, do that, and that'd be awesome.
Cool. Thank you for coming on. And,
all right, mate.
Yeah. Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. Go check out his podcast, his website, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. I think he plugged it. He plugged his website, and there'll be links on there. And go check out our YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and website, theautistickid.com. Thank you. This next song is from his band. Sorry, Apples, I'm Home. We're publicising him for this episode. I hope you enjoyed. We'll see you next time.